attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try and I
Hello
try.
And welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business, and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. Today I've caught Scott the Boom Morrison. Cutting his teeth at Saatchi & Saatchi, Scott has run the Nike business at Wieden & Kennedy and been CMO and commercial director at Levi's, Activision and Diesel. Now he brings the boom to brands and leaders to unblock, unlock and unleash commercial, creative or cultural impact that transforms business and individuals. Scott has been recognised 3 times as one of Britain's 50 most influential black men, co-authored the Amazon bestseller Creative Superpowers, is a former signed music producer, and is a non-exec director for the British Fashion Council. A phenomenally impressive chap indeed. On why business as usual doesn't cut it anymore, Scott says, "Today we are all Uber's children. We hold unreasonable, demanding expectations, and we want to have everything on our terms instantly. After all, if I can order a car now to pick me up and take me wherever I want, why can't my whole life be as simple as that?" Welcome to the show, Scott.
Thank you, Giles. It's always nice to have expectations set at the beginning. And when I heard you swear 3 times in the space of the about a minute and a half, I know where my boundaries are. But brilliant. It's so great to be here. Thank you for having me. I really look forward to sharing a discussion with you today.
Nice. Yeah, likewise. Great. Well, let's try and trip you up with our 7 quick fires.
Here we go.
So we'll start easy. Mac or PC?
Oh, Mac every day.
Boom or bust?
Boom.
Levi's or Diesel?
Oh, you do try and trip people up. I'm going to go Diesel.
Cool. Ministry or Bagleys?
Well, Bagleys all day long.
Nice. I was a Bagleys boy.
I DJed at Bagleys, so yeah. Yep. And ministry as well, but I love the vibe of Bagleys.
Yeah, same. I think I've lost my hearing as a being a Bagleys boy, but there we go. Marvin or Mandela?
Oh, that's a tough one. Mandela.
Two more. Hack more or steal elegantly?
Oh, I love that one. Hack more, because it gets you into the right place to steal more instantly, but hack more, definitely.
Nice. And this one's slightly unfair, but we're doing it anyway. Unblock, unlock, or unleash?
Oh, that is hard. I'm going to go unblock, because it's the start of everything great.
Nice, you sailed through those. They were annoyingly easy. We did try and chip you up, admittedly. But well played, well played.
Thank you.
So listen, Scott, we always start the show by asking guests to, you know, talk about their path to where they are now. So can you talk to us about your first ever jobs and then your first, what you would regard to be proper job?
Yeah, well, my first ever jobs were, I suppose they're like what most people had as their first proper jobs, which were in retail. In fact, my very, very first proper job was really boring. Picking tomatoes at the local garden centre. And after 2 weeks of being paid £1 an hour, my friend and I bought a pack of cards in and sat playing cards for about 4 hours until the farmer's daughter came in and caught us, and then we got booted off, booted out. But it was, you know, we sort of laughed about it and spent our money on some sweets. But I really got into retail quite early, and I started at British Home Stores as a Saturday boy. And I really enjoyed that because, you know, there's a few things about working at retail at an early age that I think really help you in your later life. And the first thing is you get to meet lots of people and actually understand people's needs. And I think you learn the difference between sort of doing your best and giving your all. So, you know, sometimes you go in and somebody would say, "Have you got these tracksuit bottoms?" And, you know, some people just go, "No, you know what we've got out is out. There's nothing else." And I always thought to myself, I'll run up to the stock room. I'll have a proper look. And then if I didn't find it, I'd find something else. And the look on people's faces when you make that bit of effort, you know, they constantly keep coming back. And then when I went on to go and I worked at a place called Dirty Sports, which was a a trainer shop, you know, sports shop. And again, you just learn little tricks about when people walk in, you'd look at their shoe size and you'd quickly work out what their shoe size was. So you'd then be able to think about what stock you had. So I think all those kind of things that you learn from being on the shop floor, as it were, you know, really help you understand customers better, understand communicating with each other, understand people's needs, and give you sort of little hacks on how you might perform slightly better as you do that. And I think that helped me in my first proper job, because you did ask me what's my first proper job. And that was Saatchi. So my first real job was at Saatchi & Saatchi, the advertising agency, as was at the time. And, you know, again, all of the stuff that I learned from retail really helped me there, because the philosophy was nothing is impossible. And how do you understand, you know, your audience better? How do you create emotional connections? How do you think very simply and single-mindedly? So all of that stuff, you do learn, you know, at a very early age, being at retail.
Yeah, I'm a big believer that there's no right way to do most things in life. And yet, as we record what I think is our 140th episode with you now, I can't help but spot like consistencies that pop up from previous conversations and previous guests. So just for shits and giggles, I remember Rory Sutherland was a blueberry picker and Alex Horn was a potato picker.
Oh, there
so
you go.
You're in good company there.
Good
picking company, yeah, for sure. But it's certainly the comment on first jobs in retail, that has definitely come up before. And I think lots of these things, you know, you see them clearer in the rear mirror, don't you, like later on in life. But lots of people have remarked, exactly as you have, that it's almost like, because you're front line and you're with the customer, there's no escaping behind, I don't know, email, for example, if you work in an office or wherever. And there's so much that you learn from that, because you haven't got that removal from the ultimately the people who matter.
Yeah, exactly. And the interesting thing is as well, that, you know, when I always remember when I was in advertising, and we used to do focus groups. I remember I was working on Toyota RAV4, and you know, you used to do the focus groups, and you'd sort of go into the focus groups going, yeah, I know exactly who our RAV4 customer is. You know, they're sort of a 22-year-old cool young guy, you know, or young girl, and you know, this is how they dress, this is what they like. And then you get into the focus group, and it would be, you know, men and women in their 50s and 60s driving, you know, sort of a cool RAV4. And it was not the audience you expected at all. So, you know, the beauty of being in retail is that you are literally right in front of the audience, the people who are buying your product, the people who are expecting the service. You can talk to them, you can understand more about them, you can see what their pain points are, you can help them, you know, you can really, and you can create real advocates and people who are real ambassadors for your brand right there. And I think, you know, throughout my career, I've always put a massive emphasis, you know, I was at Levi's and Diesel, about, you know, retail and the interactions that happen at retail and customer service are just so hugely important, that they are one of the kind of fundamental underpinnings of a successful business.
Yeah. Great point. We've got hundreds, if not thousands, of undergrads I know who listen to this. And one of the questions and one of the reasons we like to talk about the early parts of people's career is because there's so much anxiety about doing things the right way to start a career. So can you just explain how you ended up at Saatchi's? Like, was that intentional when you went? I know you went to university. Was that with the intent to get into advertising, or was it all just kind of serendipity?
Yeah, you know, I love that. That's the angle that you put on the conversation, because I often say when I'm mentoring or working with undergraduates, everything else is, you know, allow some serendipity into what's happening with what you're doing. Don't try and be too fixed in all the stuff that you're doing, because, you know, for me, I actually wanted to be a lawyer, weirdly enough. Social pressures and various things. I was like, oh, I'm going to be a lawyer. But then I didn't go to university to study law. I then wanted to be a journalist. I had kind of a bit of a head full of magic in my university days. And I didn't really quite know. I did an English degree. I didn't really quite know what it was that ultimately I wanted to do. And it was only one day, a friend of mine, I think Max, he just said to me, oh, I'm going to go to this Milk Round talk today. It's from Saatchi & Saatchi. I was like, oh, what do they do? He said, they're advertising. I went, okay, well, I'll go along. That sounds quite fun. Anyway, I met Marcus Peffers, who was the graduate at the time. Now he's very senior at M&C Saatchi. And their presentation literally blew me away. And it was, the reason it blew me away is because the industry and the agency, firstly, had this incredible culture of nothing is impossible, which to me was like, wow, that's kind of how I want to be. You know, I don't want to be hemmed in
in a corporate world, like law, which has very strict rules. And actually, this is something that's very different. The day in the life of what an account handler did felt really just interesting. You know, like 1 minute on a shoot, 1 minute doing this, managing clients, talking to people. I said, oh, I can do all that stuff because I've been doing it in retail for the last sort of 5-6 years. But it was also, it just felt like, you know, real entertainment. It felt like you were going to learn loads of things, do lots of interesting stuff. And the people stood in front of me were, you know, just pretty cool. And, you know, they were really passionate about what it was. And I really didn't have any idea, but they sat afterwards. We went for a drink. I took them for a drink afterwards and started talking to them about, yeah, how do I get in? What do I need to do? And then the process actually of going through the interviews was again quite interesting because I went to several interviews at various agencies, but the Saatchi process was just kind of magical. You know, it was, you know, the form that you had to fill in, it wasn't a form. It was a children's coloring book that you had to create a story around. It was just mad, you know, and I was like, how am I going to do this? Anyway, managed to get through to the second round. Then they take you to a, you know, weekend where you've got to go through a whole series of stuff. And again, it's about how do you relate to people? How do you interact? How do you build relationships? How do you speak to people more seriously? So they've got all these little tests that you don't really know are happening. And I was sat next to one of the most senior people at the agency at the time at dinner in the evening, Marilyn Baxter. And halfway through, I was like so ensconced in the process. I was like, Saatchi's is the only place I'm going to work, like completely focused on that. And I'm sat next to Marilyn Baxter. And five people came down the stairs into the restaurant on the first evening of our 2 days of, you know, mad interviews. And I said to Marilyn, who are these people? And she said, oh, we've allowed them to go to some other interviews because they've got other second round interviews at other agencies, but we've allowed them to join the process late. At which point I just went kind of slightly mad. I said, that's disgusting. I said, I've cancelled all my interviews. I'm not interviewing anywhere else. I only want to work here. I've put all my effort into this. And you're allowing other people who don't really care about Saatchi's because they're obviously going for other interviews and they're hedging their bets. So I'm really annoyed. Anyway, and then I sort of went, oh no, what am I doing? Calm down. And she went, no, okay, cool. Anyway, I ended up getting the job. And when I met Marilyn later on, you know, I'd started at Saatchi, she said to me, I could not put you forward for the role because you were so passionate about the brand and the business and Saatchi's. And it came across in our little chat at dinner. And I was like, oh my God, you know, those moments you think I've blown it here. Actually, they're the moments that can shape, you know, that bring your real character out. And so all of these little things that happened, all these serendipitous connections with, you know, my friend Max telling me to come to this event, Marcus and, you know, coming for a drink afterwards and chatting to me a bit more about it, me getting through and chatting, sitting next to Marilyn and having that big conversation. All of these things I look back on now and go, they really shaped, there was some sort of path leading me to the work in a kind of culture that brought the best out of me. And I think that's what Saatchi's really did. You know, my first role, still one of my favorite places ever to have worked, with such a brilliant culture of nothing is impossible, was really pivotal to where my career went, you know, subsequent to that.
Yeah, and I think also there's something about that age in people's life typically which does tend to have a more revolutionary mindset, doesn't it?
Yes.
So that coupled with your own, you know, that clear fire you had inside yourself to talk about these other people involved in the interview process being able to, you know, hedge their bets, etc. I can see that being a great bit. And so when you actually started there, because, you know, a lot of that story is pre-Saatchi's, but when you started, it was everything you hoped it would be.
Yeah, it was tough. It's like anything. You're adjusting from university. I came from a small village in the northwest of England. I was suddenly thrown into London. It's quite tough. But the power of working with, you know, great people, working on great brands, working in a great culture, you know, all of that starts to rub off on you, and you learn at pace. You know, you can't fail to learn in an organization like that. You can't fail to learn with such brilliant people around you. And as long as you absorb all of it and, you know, make experiments, take chances, take a few risks, do things a little bit differently, that's what was fundamentally encouraged at Saatchi's. And I encourage it for anyone in you know, in whatever capacity. I call it now positive disruption. And I think that people like Saatchi's, the culture within Saatchi's, they create positive disruption within the individual. And then that is also reflected in the culture of the organization, and in turn with the outputs that you create. And positive disruption for me is, you know, you're creating good stuff, good value. Sam Conniff will call it good trouble. You know, you're creating, you know, positive outcomes and value for your audience in the broadest sense, you know, the people you work with, the customers. But you're doing it, you know, in service of them. You know, you want to create something that really creates, you know, power, impact and value for them. And the more that you absorb that into what you're doing, and the more that you do it, the more it sort of creates this virtuous cycle. And I think great cultures, especially those at Saatchi's, that's what they did. You know, award-winning, great people, great clients, constantly knocking at the door. I mean, it was the only ad agency that they used to joke about. It was the only ad agency that your grandma's heard of, you know, and it was very true.
I don't doubt that remains true, because funnily enough, we were talking about them not so long ago with my neighbours. I mean, I have a bit of a chip on my shoulder with Saatchi and Saatchi, but that's just to do with my father had a bit of a public spat with Charles Saatchi when he refused to sell his independent agency to Saatchi's. And then catastrophically went bankrupt about 8 years later.
No.
So, you know, there's quite a wicked memory for me. But at the same time, similarly, I was talking to our neighbours who work at British Airways, and they're, you know, of course, understandably very proud of the work that British Airways has been involved in over the years, not least, you know, recently with Uncommon. But even still, I think Saatchi's remains one of the few that, you know, the general public are familiar with.
Yeah, absolutely.
For good reason. We're all, you know, in many ways, we're all a sum of our parts and some of our experiences. And I wonder where, because I want to get onto the boom mindset specifically, but it's really interesting looking and researching for today, how many experiences you have, because if we were to stick with Saatchi's, we could talk more about your Charlie and the Chocolate Factory moment with your letter invitation from Nelson Mandela. But equally, you've then gone on and you've worked, you know, one of the few people who've not only worked agency side, you've got huge client side experience as well.
Yeah.
And I think crucially, you have experience outside of this weird ad land bubble that some people live in their whole lives with your music career. So what mostly do you think has shaped the boom mindset?
Oh, wow. I mean, it's, you know, I live a weird kind of life, because I like to talk in threes, as you've already identified on Block, Unlock, Unleash. And I talk about everything in threes. You know, I talk about your impact within an organization. If you're a leader, I absolutely believe that all of the leaders that I work with are ambitious. And they're ambitious because they want to create impact, right? And impact for me is around those three things you talked about earlier, which is you create cultural impact, you create creative impact, you create commercial impact. You get that holy trinity together. So I like to live in the world of threes. And interestingly, my career, you know, the way that my career has been shaped has been agency, brands, and music. And those three things have a lot of commonality around them that all shape really around culture, creativity, and commerciality. And that, I think that's those are the three things that gel my experiences and gel my career. Because from a music front, that was completely serendipitous. My best friend was a DJ, taught me how to DJ. We started a night in London. I had my scooter stolen, and we had some money, and we said, let's make a record. That record got picked up by Sulfuric in Miami, and then they allowed us to produce another record, and we got more records. We were signed to Zed, Head Candy, Defected. And then, you know, and I met some incredible creative people, you know, musicians, artists, all sorts of things, because we were DJing all over. And, you know, you learn so much from how they think about creativity, how they deal with adversity, how they deal with self-confidence and self-doubt, you know, because you're only as good as your last gig sort of thing. So sitting around great musicians and great DJs teaches you a whole load of things. Sitting with brands, you know, and running brands, again, from a mindset point of view, you really are thinking about commercial stuff, you know, and not just boring, you know, people say, oh, commercial, boring numbers, all that sort of stuff. No, actually, when you really think through business in through different lenses, and you work with some fantastic entrepreneurs, you know, I've worked with people like Renzo Rosso, and, you know, and you work at the very heart of an organization that has entrepreneurialism built into it, you start to think about, well, how do I join dots in new and interesting ways? How do we create? And, you know, we've got these assets here. What happens if we use them in a different way to create value in a very different way? What happens if we positively disrupt within our own organization? So you start looking from that angle, And then, of course, you know, from advertising and everything else, you know, you just get that creative stuff. You also get the cultural thing because you are creating cultural shifts within organizations. You know, when you create new propositions and new thinking, it's not just about, you know, our campaign or whatever that is. You also have to go into those organizations and culturally change how they think about, you know, you talk about BA, for example. To be the world's favorite airline isn't just a strap line, as was at the time. It's a cultural movement. It's a whole shift you've got to create in the business. Everything has to, you know, marry up to, you know, everything we do makes us Britain's, the world's favorite airline, whatever, you know. And so you've got to go through everything and make sure it all joins up culturally. So when you triangulate, I use that word a lot, triangulate, but when you triangulate all those things together, you know, it's given me what I like to think kind of a broad and differentiated experience that I bring to the boom mindset. And then I try and translate that back into the organizations and the leaders I work with this kind of unique blend of experiences to get them to think differently and apply some different thinking to create positive direction, positive disruption in their own organizations.
Yeah, brilliant answer. So then if we can go on to, I mean, again, we've rather unfairly lobbed it into your quickfires, but the three stages of unblock, unlock and unleash. Is unblock more of a mindset, or could that manifest in all sorts of ways because you don't know what needs unblocking yet? Is it like a friction thing?
Yeah, so it comes from the fact that, you know, when I was in business, you know, I was running businesses, I often found that what we were great at doing, or what businesses are great at doing, is coming up with, you know, here's we've got this problem, now let's just come up with some solutions, let's brainstorm things, and then let's go off and do something about it. And nobody, great ideas are to a penny, right? Nobody's sitting in an organization going, I don't have any ideas, right? Somebody's always got something. But the two things that really stop ideas coming to life are, firstly, that we often come up with ideas that don't really solve for the problem that we're trying to solve for in the first place. And then the second thing is that we don't even action the ideas. Yeah, you how many brainstorms have you been in? I mean, I've been in hundreds where there's a load of post-it notes. And it's like, yeah, we've got a load of stuff. Nothing ever happens with the ideas. They just sort of sit there. And then, you know, 6 months later, everyone's going, what happened to that? The outputs from that brainstorm? Well, I don't know. They're back in the stationery cupboard. I don't know where, so it made me think about, well, what is a useful process to go through, and what would make more sense is actually, if you start with unblocking, then actually you really understand. You understand two things. So for me, unblocking is about, well, what does success look like? You know, I often work with board teams and they're like, we want to create a vision for the future. And what are we thinking about doing? Or just, you know, this team needs to come together and rally around something. What is that? So we need to actually get out of everyone's head. What does success look like for this group of people, for this team, for this business, for this organization? And really be clear about that. Because I'm amazed as well how often we start something without having success. Yeah, what are we trying to achieve at the end? And once you understand that, then you can start having different conversations about, well, what do we need to unblock in order to get there? Like you say, what are the frictions? I mean, sometimes it's mindset. Sometimes it's, you know, people. Sometimes it's processes. Sometimes it's just, you know, old behaviors, old ways of doing things. Sometimes it's stakeholder relationships, whatever that might be. But until we absolutely start talking about those things and getting them out, then, you know, you don't really know what you're dealing with. But the great thing is because you're actually thinking about success maybe in a different perspective, it opens up the conversations around what you're thinking about blockers are, because suddenly you're a bit more objective. It's like, yeah, if we want to get there, well, we can't have these processes anymore that we have. But if I say to somebody, what's getting in your way right now? They'd never talk about the processes because they're just like, you know, ooh, don't really want to say anything about it. But once you've got a fresh perspective on where you're going, you can start having conversations about what's not fit for purpose. Then once you do that, then you start to unlock the new ideas and new thinking. And that's where you can have ideas. But again, thinking early, you mentioned about, you know, stealing, and that's, you know, elegantly stealing thinking is a really great way of getting to smart solutions that will help solve your problem. Because once you've got a different perspective, you go, actually, there's something over there that's really useful that we might be able to use now. Don't, you know, get the ego in the way of trying to invent it yourself. Just bring something in that's already proven to work. And the final bit about unleashing is that's where you create the action. So you've got clarity on what it is that you're trying to go for. You've got clarity on what's getting in the way. You've thought through how you overcome those barriers and blockers, and then you create the action and you make that happen and you go. So it's a process that overcomes the inertia of ideas not happening and the challenge of not solving for the right puzzles. I call them puzzles rather than problems. And it's, again, it's a three, but it actually helps people through a very simple process that they can replicate and keep using to really come up with stuff that's going to create positive disruption and is going to absolutely ultimately create impact.
Nice. And do you think that people, you kind of hinted at it earlier, but do you think that people within, say, a board struggle to come up or agree on what success looks like? Like, is that a primary issue?
More often than not, I would say that there is some semblance of knowing what they're trying to achieve, but sometimes that sense of achievement might be quite siloed or might be owned by somebody else or might be not as coherent as it could be. And also it's sometimes quite intangible. As in, you know, it's kind of like, oh, we're trying to be the number one blah in the world or whatever. And that can feel quite intangible because it's like, well, what does that look like? And where are we now? And how do we get there? And actually, you know, the exercises that I work with teams on really help make that very tangible and make it very real and make it very contextualized. But again, simplify it down into some really ownable, manageable chunks. Because the idea is, I always have this theory. You know that story about Alien? I don't know if you know. There's a great story about Alien, the film, and they were trying to sell that. They couldn't sell it because, you know, nobody really understood the story and they kept walking around, going around. And then somebody said, I get Alien. It's Jaws in space, isn't it? And everyone went, yeah, it's Jaws in space. And, you know, huge, you know, congratulations. And then they sold it immediately, you know. So I'm like, your version of the future, your vision, it needs to be the Jaws in space moment for your organization. You can't talk about, you know, blah, 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 and all this, but you've got to create it so that people go, I absolutely understand that in the clarity of Jaws in space. But also you've got to make it visual. You've got to make it textual. You've got to make it tangible. So there are elements in the exercise that I do. I mean, I get people to create a movie poster, ironically. But in that movie poster, there's so many great things that help people go, right, I know what that means. I know where we're heading. I know what we're doing. And that clarity is universal, you know, with boards. And actually what's great for board teams is that they create something that they can then just show to the organization. Not a 52-page PowerPoint deck. Just show me that and get people behind it. Because, yeah, again, if you're on a board, what you should be in the business of as well is rallying cries, right? Yeah, call to actions, you know, rallying cries, not in the business of 52-page decks, you know, and trying to, you know, get people, you know, take people through loads and loads of stuff. People in the organization, they want, you know, if you want to create real impact, you've got to create a movement within the organization. And I think people forget that, you know, I think people can sometimes get lost in their own need for complexity rather than, you know, switching to, what's the most simple way I can make this? Because if you give simplicity to people in an organization, it's so easy for them to make it happen. It comes back to my Saatchi days, you know, single-minded propositions. Throw me one tennis ball, I'll catch it every time. Throw me 10, I might catch two. So, you know, that's what I one of my firm core tenets of business is just make it so simple that people just get it straight away and they know what's expected of them and they off they go and they go and create the impact you want to see.
Time, weather, and...
Today's podcast is sponsored by No One. Whether you need research, brand, or strategy, No One brings you absolutely nothing. With simple templates and drag-and-drop tools, you can have a great-looking nothing in minutes. If you have a real marketing challenge you'd like to chat about, though, just email giles@gasp.agency. And use the offer code Giles to get 10% off nothing. Brought to you by No One.
Time, weather, and...
Yeah, that's great. I love creative movement. That's really powerful. And I suppose to use the words or example you used earlier when you talked about maybe a want to be the number one whatever as a, you know, as a sign of success or an end point people are aiming for. I suppose that's more of an end rather than a means to an end, right? So the creating a movement is the means.
Yeah, and also you know. Like I said earlier, if you really want to create impact, you have to think about those three different areas: cultural, commercial, and creative. And cultural movements are needed, because if you just say, I want to be number one, you know, people go, right, okay, we'll be number one. And that means I need to go away and save loads of costs, because that means we'll be number one profitable. Or, you know, we need to go and sell more stuff, because that will literally be the number one in that. And actually, being number one has many different facets to it. And unless you really strip those out and go, you know, and actually just make it more meaningful, because more often than not, it's not just about being number one. It's probably about being something else, and something a bit more, you know, ownable and tangible that people really can get. And you then need to think about, how does that translate through the culture of the organization? And that's why creating movements are really powerful, because, you know, once people really know what it is they're going for, you create and you power people up to own different bits of it. And rather than you having to oversee this whole thing and try and micromanage your way through it, things start happening. Positive disruption starts cropping up all over the business, all over different departments. And then that sort of, once you get that kind of flywheel going and you get that groundswell of action happening across the organization, it takes on a life of its own. And that's great, because then you're sort of steering things and nudging the tiller on great stuff, rather than having to generate new thinking, having to, you know, make lots of micromanagement decisions across everything. Create the movement, create the clarity, create the simplicity, and then, you know, lead with consistency, and, you know, impact starts to roll through the organization.
Yeah, perfect. And do you find that approach works whether you're pointing it at an individual leader or a collection of leaders in a boardroom, like, you know, entire businesses? Is that flexible enough to work one-to-one, for example?
Yeah, so I use it when I'm exec coaching. You know, it's exactly the same principles.
Yeah.
You know, what do we need to unblock, unlock, and unleash for you as an individual to create the impacts that you want to see? And I've just completed it's been about 9 months now for a global entertainment business. So I've been running a leadership program with their teams, and there's a kind of a collective sense, because, you know, it's a very specific group in the organization, and they're being tasked to grow the business. But it's at an individual level, because each of the individuals is thinking about how do they create the movement, the bigger movement that we're creating in the organization for their part of the business and for their teams. And so it works, it's working for them. But actually, when you bring them all together, you're seeing a completely different mindset shift in how they're operating, which again is fantastic. And, you know, it's starting to, you know, I mean, we've just done some reviewing on it now, and there's millions of dollars return already coming back into the business by them just simply positively disrupting the way they lead. And then they're thinking around those three factors of commercial, creative, and cultural. And it's great to see them really embracing the fundamental that you've got to create that movement. And it starts with you as an individual, but then you power up your people to bring that movement to the organization. And then you start to see some fantastic results.
There's two words that came up in the research. I mean, I've got dozens and dozens of runouts in front of me here with scrawlings of a lunatic all over them. But one of them I've circled quite aggressively, but enthusiastically, is stating intent.
Yes.
I love the idea about stating intent being an underused tool, because, you know, it doesn't force you, but there's real ownership about that.
Oh, it's, I always say it is the most underused business tool, because it genuinely is. And it's based on, you know, kind of Jungian psychology. So it's, yeah, it's rooted in proper scientific, well, as much proper scientific as you can say. But, you know, Jungian theory suggests that, you know, when you state intent for yourself, then you get alignment. And if you think of an organization as a human body, so, you know, if you just think of the leadership, the board, as the brain, for all intents and purposes, I'm not saying that, you know, just figuratively speaking, but that's the head and it's leading. You know, you've got the heart, the passion in people and stuff. If your brain is right and it's very clear on what is going on and what needs to happen, and it can state that clarity, then things move around in the way that, you know, you want the organization to move around. So helping the leaders and the brain be able to state with clarity what it is that they're looking to do sets the expectation for the rest of the organization. And so stating intent is literally having the confidence and the clarity as a leader to be able to say, this is what we're doing. This is what I expect. and to be saying it consistently time after time. And then the more you do it, then generally what happens is you get this alignment happening because people know exactly where they need to be and what they're going to do. They've got some freedom around the framework, but they know that ultimately this is what we're trying to do. So they then start going, right, how do I do that in my part of the organization? You don't have to be rigid and, you know, it's not about just doing things with rigidity. It's about going, right, that's where we're trying to get to now. How do I make that happen here? It's like your brain. If you say, right, I'm going to buy a red Mini, you get in your old car, you're driving around, you suddenly see 1,000 red Minis, right? But you see some with, you know, different wheels, some with a white roof, some of the Union Jack, you know, headlights and stuff. And that's what's happening in the organization. They know that you want a red Mini. Their red Mini might be a red Mini, but with a white roof or with, you know, different wing mirrors. But fundamentally, it's a red Mini. But you're allowing for that freedom within the framework. But what you're doing is you're just consistently helping people know where they're going, know their direction, know the intent. And so there's a consistency, what they expect from you. If they're doing something that you're asking them to do, then they can ask for help as long as it's, you know, in line with that. They've got your support. You've got their back. You're going to help them deliver what it needs. You know, you're going to help with the resources because it's all aligned behind that common goal that we're all going to try and achieve. But it's incredible how often we don't do that. And, you know, as leaders, I look back at my career, there's times I hadn't done it with consistency. But I know that the results that I got when I started to use intent, you know, literally with intent, but as I started to use that business tool, the results that I got were far more impactful than without.
Have you spotted, given I mentioned or at least referred to the kind of diverse career you've had in terms of organization types, shapes, sizes, everything.
Yeah.
Have you spotted like a consistency in leaders who exist within them, and even your client base today, if you know, want to add to that sample pool, or do you think that the leadership you saw, maybe agency side and then the other side, client side, are all much of a muchness, or do they typically, you know, behave and thrive differently in different industries?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I think from a, you know, that's why when I talk about the boom mindset, I've distilled some of the behaviors, just some of the things that I observe that leaders, ambitious leaders who create impact, you know, the things that they do fundamentally that shape the way that things are. And then one of the key things I think is, well, there's two things. Firstly, this willingness to positively disrupt. I think that really makes leaders stand out. You know, ambitious leaders stand out because they recognize that what we are doing, you know, whether we're in business, whether in music, whatever, is you know, I'm doing something that I love doing and I'm passionate about, but I want to do that in a way that creates value to my audience or to my customers or, you know, to my team. And so they have this kind of different approach, whether it's, you know, they're 10 times more magnanimous than other people. You know, they always want to help people. They are really curious. They really want to understand more about the audience and the customers they work with. They have a sense of flexibility, but they also have this thing where inside everything they do, they have what I call this idea of a learn fast culture. So they don't put an awful lot of importance on either failing or succeeding. And I think that's a key thing because, you know, quite often, you know, as leaders, we're afraid of failing. Or we have the contrary thing where, you know, hey, everyone, let's, you know, fail fast and all that sort of thing. But both of those things are kind of, you know, when you go back to a human level, you know, failure from a very young age, we're taught that it's a wrong thing. Whether we like it or not, we're taught it's not good to fail. And sometimes we see the consequences of failure in society and everything else. And therefore, we're subtly programmed not to fail. And on the contrary side of that, you know, success is something that's interesting. But then sometimes with success comes ego. The more successful you get, the more ego you have, you know, the less open you are to learning and trying new things, and indeed leading in a way that shares your vast experience with people in your teams, you know, and hubris sets in and all that sort of thing. So if you put too much onus on either of those two things, then there's a sense of danger and a lack of progression ultimately that leads to, you know, your downfall.
So one thing I've noticed with these leaders is that they don't adopt either failure or success as key kind of currency. And what they do is they learn fast. So learnings become the currency of great leadership. So it doesn't matter whether you fail or succeed. Actually, what you're doing is I'm trying to get here. I'm going to learn in the process. Some things I'm not going to do well. Some things I'm going to do well. But in all cases, I am constantly going to be learning. I am constantly going to, you know, push myself. I'm constantly going to reflect on what I'm doing and seeing whether it's fit for purpose or not. And I'm constantly, you know, going to be on this path. And that means that, you know, people often say they're lifelong learners, all that sort of thing. And I think that it's very, very true that great ambitious leaders, that's how they see themselves. They never close themselves off to curious, you know, to be curious about people. You know, you'll often see them in a room talking to all sorts of different people in a room. You know, and I often remember some of the, you know, biggest producers in the world will come and speak to some of the people, you know, people who carrying records, you know, or whatever else, or go into every record shop and speak to everybody who is behind the desks selling records. You know, great leaders will, you know, and I talked about Nelson Mandela, we might talk about it again later. Yeah, they do things in just incredible ways that fire people up because they have this incredible ability to connect. But it's because they're curious, they want to learn. They don't shut themselves off in ivory towers.
Yeah. This is going to be the last question from me because I've got a couple of listener questions I want to put to you, but it's mentioning the great man himself, the late great Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
We will link to a wonderful isolated talk that Scott kindly did for us during lockdown. It's quite short, I think it's about 10 minutes, but you share two, but particularly, you know, particularly this one beautiful story about Nelson Mandela. And what's interesting to me is there's almost a contrast when I think of and see and hear the word boom to this kind of big, loud volume. But the stories you talk about and the style of leadership you talk about are often not necessarily quiet, but quite calm. And your Mandela story, which I don't want to spoil now, we'll link, as I say, in this show notes, is actually a very quiet story of sorts, right? And I'm not suggesting Nelson Mandela was quiet in his impact, because I think few have been as loud and proud in terms of impact. But there is often people kind of that loudest voice in the room type problem we might have in boardrooms, where often the leaders are quite the opposite, right?
Yeah, it's such a great point, because I always talk about, you know, the business I am in is the business of impact. You know, and I don't talk about, you know, I'm not in the business of change or transformation, all that sort of stuff, because they're just kind of byproducts of impact. If you're an ambitious leader and you want to create impact, then impact is relative to what it is that you're in. And impact can be as quiet as you like, or it can be bombastic and it can be loud. And I completely agree. You know, I work with all sorts of leaders, some who are quietly spoken, but have an incredibly sharp mind and will power their people up to create the impacts that they want to see. And I've worked with leaders who equally are loud, and we work with them to transform that energy into, you know, positive disruption that creates the right impact. And I think it's really about, you know, if you want to create impact and you are ambitious, knowing where it is that you're trying to get to and what it is that you're trying to achieve, and then working through the process of getting to action is just incredibly powerful, because it really all boils down to, you know, impact is about really knowing yourself and knowing where it is that you want to get to, and then taking the right steps to make that happen. But it's always about bringing people with you. It's always about, you know, positive disruption is always about positively disrupting those around you, your peers, you know, the people in your organization, and getting them to come along with you. That's the Nelson Mandela story, which we'll let people listen to. But it is all about, as a leader, you have an incredible amount of power, and infused in the wrong way, you know, it will fold around you. You know, the business will go bust. But when used in the right way, when you really understand who you are, what you need to do, what the organization needs from you, what customers need from you, how you can make that happen, how you can join those dots in interesting ways, then impact is just incredible. And it can be, you can just be impactful just by walking into the room and people feeling a sense of wow, you know, this leader's got our back. You can, you know, say two or three sentences and have an incredible amount of impact. Or you can, you know, lead the charge from the front and, you know, be the rallying cry of the fundamental movement that you want to make happen in an organization. But impact is, you know, manifold, but at the heart of it, it's clarity and simplicity about the direction you're wanting to take and how you bring your people with you in order to create that positive disruption that really brings the impact that you want to see.
Brilliant. I'm going to hurl a couple of listener questions at you now.
Great, go for it.
So, asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. But we've got two. Megan asks, how can I use the business unusual mindset to become a better creative?
Oh, great. Yeah, so that's one of the things, I talk about in the boom mindset, which is there's a difference between businesses in the bust mindset are the ones that do business as usual. So they're the ones that, you know, you'll hear that kind of language around, you know, oh, it's how we've always done things here, you know, oh, we don't do it that way, you know, that kind of classic old stuff. And business unusual is fundamentally part of the boom mindset, which is, you know, we think about all aspects of our business, all aspects of who we are creatively, commercially and culturally. And we think about how can we join the dots in new and interesting ways. So it might be that I have a whole series of exercises that I break things down. So, you know, when we talked earlier about hacking, if you take what feels like the initial challenge that you're dealt with as a creative, so I don't know if you're thinking about a brief or something else, but you start to break it down into different chunks. So don't just take the brief as it comes to you. Go a bit deeper, ask some deeper questions, ask some other questions about all aspects of the business that you're working with. Think through the brief in a different way. Think about the audience in a different way. Try and look through some different lenses and maybe similar businesses, then go, well, actually, who else has dealt with this kind of challenge before in an interesting way? And start to expand your mind outside of just the initial framework. And then once you start thinking like that, you've suddenly got this ability to unlock different thinking. So you might go, well, actually, these companies over here, or this celebrity over there, or I don't know, 10 years ago when I was working in a tomato farm, I had a very similar challenge, you know, and suddenly you start to bring new and interesting thinking. You might say, actually, I'm going to go and speak to these three people who I'd never speak to before, but I'm going to chat to them about, you know, this brief, this creative that I've got. And the more diverse points of view and perspective you can bring to something, again, the more dots you've got to join. And it's this thing of, you know, bringing all those, just literally laying everything out and going, right, now I've got this very different playset that I had previously. You know, I've now got these different inputs from here. I've got something from over here. And once you've got that kind of much more expansive mindset, then you can start thinking business unusual, because you're outside of the realms of the sector or the category that you are in. You've got some very different perspectives from people. You might have some different consumer perspectives that you'd never even thought about. But you're also, you cast the net broadly. And suddenly, you're not just thinking about this very narrow thing. You're thinking about a much broader set of possibilities. When you think about, you know, back to nothing is impossible. But when you think about a broad set of possibilities, you've got a much better way of solving things and coming up with creative solutions. Because you're not just thinking about, I don't know, it might be, I don't know what sort of creative Megan is, but if you're just thinking about, you know, I don't know, TV ads or print or some online, but actually you start thinking about, well, what's the customer experience like then on this? Or
yeah,
how do we communicate one-to-one, you know, a branch with somebody? Or what's our retail, you know, whatever it might be, the idea suddenly spreads and becomes much bigger, much broader, and therefore much more impactful. And I've seen, I mean, I had some wonderful, I did some work with a global drinks brand a year ago where we asked some of these questions. What does business unusual thinking look like here? And we went from what felt like a real restraint, a constraint for them, into something that was incredibly magical. By using their existing infrastructure, they're able to think incredibly differently about a challenge that had been on the CEO's mind for, you know, about two or three years. She was over the moon. And it's like, well, yeah, it's incredible how once you start to shift from business as usual, how do we operate in this category, to business unusual, how do we operate in a much bigger way? You know, let's forget about the category for now. Let's just think about what kind of impact we could create you suddenly start to think about your business in a very different way. And that works creatively as well as commercially.
Yeah, definitely. That's a great answer.
Thank you.
Question two is from Kieran. Kieran asks, what is puzzle mentality and how can it help individuals and teams?
That's another great question. Thanks, Kieran. Well, there's two ways of looking at the unblock phase, interestingly. When we first go into it, usually people come to me and say, oh, these are all the problems we've got. These are problems, right? Now, the interesting thing about using language as part of impact is that if you use the wrong language, then you can very quickly start to stay in the business as usual thing that we were just talking about. So problems for me, as a word, are business as usual kind of mindset, because everyone's got problems. We've got all sorts of problems in our lives as well as in our business. But what happens is psychologically, nobody wants to own a problem because it's like, oh God, I've got this problem. And no, and everyone just moans and, you know, creates noise around problems. They desperately seek one owner because you want to narrow it right down. That's your problem. It's not mine. It's your problem to deal with. Problems, ultimately, if they don't get solved, you become the problem. And if you become the problem, you know, guess what happens? So problems are fraught as a piece of language. They're fraught with kind of consequences that actually you end up going down that road because of the use of language. So I switch when I'm working with clients. We don't talk about problems. We talk about puzzles. And it's really interesting when you start talking about, we're going to unblock some puzzles that we need to work on, everybody. People go, oh, that's interesting. Why have you switched? And the reason is because when you start talking about puzzles, puzzles in life are things that people gather around to solve. No one ever, if you go up to somebody and say, oh God, I've got this problem, people go, oh God, you know, they'd be saying, I've got this puzzle, can you give me a hand with it? Everyone's like, yeah, of course, yeah. They don't even know what the puzzle is. It could be Sudoku, a crossword, or it could be the most complex business challenge they've ever faced. But people are more likely to go, yeah, I'll help you with the puzzle. And puzzles are collaborative. They have a sense of sort of gamification about them. We're familiar with puzzles. We know that there's always a solution to a puzzle. More often than not, you know, even if a Rubik's Cube is hard, we know that somebody solved it somewhere. So, and also puzzles just engender collaboration. The puzzles want more people to solve them, whereas problems look for one owner. So you start playing on, you know, sort of what happens in society. You know, when we talk about problems, this thing happens. When we talk about puzzles, this thing happens. So puzzle mentality is, it starts to engender a sense of collaboration, teamwork, solvability, hope, that the thing that's in front of us, this puzzle that might be the biggest business puzzle you're ever going to face, by the way, actually is solvable. And if we put the right people on it and collectively work on it, we're going to have some fun and we're going to make it happen. And so that shift is what I use in the unlocking phase. I want people to think about in what ways might we solve this puzzle that creates the impact that we want to see.
I love that. That's fantastic. That's really smart as well. Because I this was probably going back about, I don't know, maybe 100 episodes, but I remember a point made by a really smart guy that the great Rob Schwartz put me in touch with, the TBWA.
Oh yeah.
And he was responsible globally for DE&I.
Yeah.
And the point that he made was, what one of the, I suppose, problems was that as soon as businesses appoint somebody or a department into that role, everyone else in the organization sees it as that person's problem to fix.
Yeah.
And I wonder, actually, in that example, that's exactly where the puzzle mentality, I think, could be hugely powerful, because you're not seeing it as someone else's problem. You're seeing it as a collaboration. That's wonderful.
That's so true. It's like, yeah, as soon as you say, like, this is a puzzle we've all got to fix, now who's going to help us find the first four corners, you know, like in a jigsaw? Then people
we're
go,
at that
oh,
stage
okay,
with
right.
my two, yeah. We're at that stage with my two daughters,
right?
Yeah, and it's actually the other thing. Maybe this is just true of doing jigsaws with my daughters, although they're not necessarily always rewarding. But the fact that they are rewarding, like puzzles, they're there to, you know, they what people want to fix them, right? They know,
yeah,
there's that feedback and that enjoyment and reward. Whereas problems, I suppose, you could almost cue people just moaning about a problem, all agreeing it's a problem, and then going about their day.
That's it. It just creates inertia. And that's it. I think that's a great point, is why, you know, in organizations, why sit around like feeling sad about problems and talking about, when actually you can, you know, go to work, have fun, use people's brain in the right way, get the diversity, cognitive diversity in the thinking by making things fun and engaging and talking about puzzles, and then going, you know, I really welcome your point of view. I really welcome what you got to say. Bring it. bring it into something that really gamifies it and makes people feel like they're contributing in the right way, rather than people feeling like, you know, the minute I say something that's good here, this problem's going to be mine to solve.
Yeah.
That's the thing, that nobody wants to solve, you know, start speaking up about solving a problem, because it's then passed over to them, like pass the parcel. Whereas when it's a puzzle, it's like, well, I've got a corner here, someone else got a corner over there. Right, now how do we make that happen? And that's a fundamental shift in how we use people in the right way.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a brilliant answer. Cool. Right, Scott, the last final part of the interview is our four pertinent poses. Starting with, what advice would you give to your younger self?
That's a good question. And I thought a lot about that. And I was a bit like, I'm starting to overthink it. But I wanted to give something that, back to when we started, you know, you were saying a lot of undergraduates listen to this. And my advice to my younger self would be to spend more time recognizing and focusing on my strengths than trying to fix my weaknesses. And I spent an inordinate amount of time, and I think, you know, the world of work is geared to getting everybody to focus on their weaknesses. You know, you have an end of year thing. Yeah, well done on that. Now, actually, what you're not good at is this, and this. And I spent a lot of time trying to, like, work out how to be the best account person I could be, or this or that. And the reality was, I overlooked for a long time some of the skills that I only discovered quite late on, before I started my business, that made me start my business, that I'm a synthesizer. I didn't realize this until one of my dear friends told me, Scott, you're a synthesizer. You just need to focus on that. And what he meant was, I'm able to take lots of complex thinking and just turn it into, like the Jaws in Space moment, I can turn it into quite simple things. And that has been the bedrock of my business. And, you know, and it's hard to get to simple, don't get me wrong, but actually it's a very powerful currency when you're in the boardroom and when you're talking to people. And now I dial a lot of that up. I found it very rewarding personally. And I think back to if I'd done that a bit more when I was, you know, an account handler, or when I was working in marketing, I did try and overcomplicate things and made it simpler, I would have probably enjoyed it a lot more. So, you know, I really wish that I'd done that earlier. And I think, you know, there's lots of things now at Strength Finders and stuff where you can actually really dig into, what are my core strengths? Ask yourself those questions and really focus in on those. It's a real point of differentiation. It's a real point of uniqueness, and it will help you stand out if you're looking for roles or in interviews, and it'll give you something that you become very passionate about.
Yeah, that's really, yeah, I love that. It's one of those things, I think, that actually I'd be surprised if anyone listening doesn't recognize something in that point. I feel
I think everybody's got strengths, and I think sometimes it's a very British thing, but we often downplay strengths. You know, we hide our skills under a bushel. If you go to the US, it's very, very different. So I think it's quite a uniqueness to the kind of British cultural thing, where we are so deferent to being given feedback about our weaknesses that we end up spending an inordinate amount of time trying to be better at this and better at that. When actually, the thing I learned is, if you're not good at, you know, I wasn't particularly great at doing the numbers on when I was at Diesel, for example, when I was commercial director, but I bought in a wonderful woman from the finance team who became my right hand. I said that this is a story I want to tell, and this is what I need, the numbers, you know, this is how I need the numbers. And she would then go and work the numbers, you know, so when we were putting in the numbers for the end of the year or whatever we needed to do for resources, she'd have all the hard data at the back and I could tell the story. But her strength was then she could do all that. I didn't need to try and be great at that. But as a team, it worked really, really well, you know. And I think if you can find your right-hand person in most things in life, that complement your strengths, then I think that's a good thing to do.
It's a great quote, isn't it? I think, is it Einstein? I don't know, someone else. Someone who's certainly smarter than me once said something along the lines of, don't judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree. And that's, I think, right, that there's so many businesses that are just dead set on trying to get their fish to climb trees.
He's absolutely right. Don't do it.
Yeah. Number two then, if you could banish one thing from the industry, what would it be and why? People often struggle with this one.
Oh,
it to one.
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of self-congratulation and platitudes around mediocre work that doesn't create impact. You know, mediocre things, mediocre campaigns, mediocre initiatives that really don't create any impact. And there's a lot of backslapping that goes on about it. And I've probably been guilty about it myself in the past. But, you know, I really would welcome if there was more great work, you know, done. Yeah, kind of less work that was more impactful rather than loads of mediocre work that really doesn't do anything but gets shouted about and wins awards and stuff. And the really great creative stuff that's really thought through and really different and really differentiated really doesn't cut through sometimes because there's so much noise behind all the other stuff that it's a bit like, well, it's just another thing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that, especially the congratulation part of it. Yeah. I think this industry is severely broken in that respect.
Absolutely. But,
there we go.
Absolutely.
And number three, could you recommend some books to our listeners?
Yeah. So I incidentally, on my website, I've got a little thing called the Boom Book Club. So there's some recommendations on there too. But I've got three that I've been recommending lately. One is The Mountain Is You by Brianna, I think it's Wiest, W-I-E-S-T. But it's a great way of thinking about the boom mindset. And, you know, we all want to create impact. We all want to be, you know, well, not all of us, but, you know, if you want to create impact and you want to be a successful leader or succeed in what it is that you're trying to do, it's also recognizing what are the blockers in yourself that can hold you back. And I found that this book, you know, working with people I've been coaching and also some of the organizations I've recently worked with, it helps them understand, you know, when we're doing this and we're trying to get here, that at an individual level, we might find some blockers. So how do we think about those and how do we overcome them? So that's one book I recommend. I absolutely recommend all of Ryan Holiday's books that are based on Stoicism. The Ego is the Enemy, etc. The Obstacle is the Way. All of those books, I think, just give you a fantastic perspective on a different point of view on mindset. So back to what we were saying earlier about quiet impact. There's a lot of work in there behind Stoicism that gives you a perspective on quiet impact. And then finally, a book I recommend to everybody that I speak to really is The Road Less Stupid by Keith Cunningham. And it's Keith Cunningham was on the chair of loads of businesses in America. And the book is all about how to ask questions, like literally ask these questions in the book and they will about 10x your ability, I think, to lead with impact. Because great leadership is not coming with all the answers. It's often just coming with all the questions and allowing people to create the answers for themselves and then helping them unblock, unlock, unleash the action that they need to create.
Great. Well, The Mountain Is You, I don't think it's ever come up before, but it's such a good title. I love it.
It's a great book. Great. It's a great read.
Yeah. Well, we'll link to those. We'll also link to the Boom Book Club.
Thank you.
And then finally, we always dedicate every episode to someone and we bestow or hospital pass that honour, depending on your view, to our guest. So would you kindly dedicate this episode?
I'm going to dedicate it to my mum, actually, who was my biggest inspiration and embodies loads of the stuff that I do with the Boom and gave me the opportunities in life that I have and I'm very lucky to have and very grateful for. And unfortunately, she died last February. But she was, you know, absolutely right to the day she left us, was probably the most positive and inspirational person, you know, in the world. So I dedicate it to her.
Amazing. Well, firstly, I'm truly sorry for your loss. I hope you don't mind me saying, in my research, we found a short story where you talk about her juggling seven jobs to give you the opportunities that
absolutely
she afforded you.
She's incredible.
She sounds like an incredible woman. So this episode is very proudly dedicated to your mum.
Thank you.
Well, listen, Scott, I've adored this episode. It's been fantastic. It's been a real pleasure to talk. We'll link to everything we've discussed so far, but for anyone who wants more, where else can they get more Scott Morrison?
Great. Well, yeah, they can contact me or my team. The work that I've talked about today, we have Lead with Boom programs, Boom Mindset Masterclasses, and my Team Boom programs that I work with all my clients from various sectors on and love doing. I'm speaking about both leading with Boom and Boom Mindset at various conferences in the summer. So I'm going to be at the Global QSP Conference Summit in Portugal, 15 seconds. Conference in Graz in Austria, and various other speaking engagements. Just done some stuff at the Marketing Society and more to come. I'm on LinkedIn, and we'll be posting various things up on LinkedIn about the Boom Mindset. And I've written a series of blogs as well that are on my website. But one in particular I thought might be interesting for your listeners, which is the 10 traits of the future client. So some of the stuff we didn't get to talk about today. But again, I wrote it quite a while ago, and a lot of it sort of seems to come through. But if you're looking at what I think the impact and leadership behaviors that people are looking for in the client of the future, and how to get the best out of a client agency relationship as a result of it, there is a blog on my website which is all about that.
Awesome. Well, we're going to make sure that's included in links. So if you're listening to this now, if you just open up your whatever device you're listening on, you'll find links to precisely that blog and everything else Scott has just mentioned. So thanks again, mate. This has been ace.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. And may I say, you know, I love the work you all do, and I've followed you. Well, I mean, we've worked together on stuff, you know, and I think the stuff that you do and the work that you do and this podcast is great. And I'm, you know, thank you for having me on, and thanks for all the listeners for spending the time listening to it. And I really look forward to hearing it and hearing more.
Awesome. Thanks, mate. I didn't even pay you to say that. That's lovely. Thank you very much, buddy. I really, really appreciate that. I also appreciate everyone listening. So if you've enjoyed this episode, please do share and review the podcast. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find GASP online, or you can just email the mouthful, that is calltoaction@gasp.agency.
I can't get no call to action. I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try, and I try.